4. Locke didn't find it particularly easy to eat lunch while watching a dozen swimming men being pulled apart by a Gerishti devilfish, but he decided that his master merchant of Emberlane had probably seen worse in his many imaginary sea voyages, and he kept his true feelings far from his face. Noon was well past, the penance bouts were over, and the revel masters had moved on to the judicial forfeitures. This was a polite way of saying that the men in the water were murderers, rapists, slavers, and arsonists, selected to be colourfully executed for the amusement of the revel crowds. Technically speaking, they were armed and would receive lesser sentences if they could somehow contrive to slay whatever beast they were matched against. But the beasts were always as nasty as their weapons were laughable, so mostly they were just executed. The devilfish's tentacles were 12 feet long, the same length as its undulating grey and black striped body. The creature was confined within a 60-foot circle of cages and platforms, along with a number of screaming, flailing, water-treading men, most of whom had long since dropped their slender little daggers into the water. Nervous guards, armed with crossbows and pikes, patrolled the platform, shoving prisoners back into the water if they tried to scramble out. Occasionally, the devilfish would roll over in the churning red waters, and Locke would catch a glimpse of one lidless black eye the size of a soup bowl, not unlike the bowl currently held in his hands.
"More, Master Fellwhite?"
Conte hovered nearby with the silver tureen of chilled soup cradled in his hands. White-fleshed iron sea prawns floated in a heavy red tomato base seasoned with peppers and onions. Don and Doña Salvara were a peculiar sort of droll.
"No, Conte, most kind, but I'm well satisfied for the time being."
Locke set his soup bowl down beside the broached cask of 559, actually a bottle of lowly 50-crown 550 liberally mixed with the roughest overpriced rum Jean had been able to get his hands on, and took a sip of the amber liquor from his snifter. Even mixed with crap, the counterfeit was delicious. Grauman stood attentively behind Locke's hosts, who were seated opposite Locke at the intimate little table of oiled silverwood. Doña Sofia toyed unself-consciously with a subtlety of gelled orange slices, paper thin and arranged in whorls to form edible tulip blossoms. Don Lorenzo stared down at the snifter of brandy in his hands, his eyes still wide.
"It seems almost sacrilegious."
Despite this sentiment, the Don took a deep gulp of the stuff, satisfaction well evident in the lines of his face. In the distance behind him, something that might have been a severed torso flew up into the air and came back down with a splash. The crowd roared approval. Osterschalin brandy was famously aged for a minimum of 7 years after distillation and blending. It was impossible for outsiders to get their hands on a cask any sooner than that. The House of Bell Oster's factors were forbidden even to speak of the batches that were not yet on sale. The location of the vintners' aging houses was a secret that was reportedly guarded by assassination when necessary. Don Lorenzo had been struck stupid when Locke had casually offered up a cask of 559. He had nearly thrown up when Locke had just as casually opened the seal and suggested they share it with lunch.
"It is," Locke chuckled. "The brandy is the religion of my house. So many rules, so many rituals, so many penalties."
No longer smiling, he drew a quick finger across his throat.
"It's possible we're the only people in history to have an unaged sample with a lunch of soup. I thought you might enjoy it."
"I am."
The Don swirled the liquor in his glass and stared at it, as though hypnotized by the soft caramel-colored translucence.
"And I'm dead serious about what sort of scheme you've got up your sleeve, Lucas."
"Well,"
Locke swirled his own drink theatrically.
"There have been 3 invasions of Emberlane in the past 250 years. Let's be frank. The succession rites of the Kingdom of the Marrows always involves armies and blood before they involve blessings and banquets. When the Grafs quarrel, the Ostershalin Mountains are only landward barrier and the site of heavy fighting. This fighting inevitably spills down the eastern slopes of the mountains, right through the vineyards of the House of Bel-Oster. How could it be different this time? Thousands of men and horses coming over the passes, trampling the vineyards, sacking everything in sight. It might even be worse now that we have fire oil. Our vineyards could be ashes half a year from now. You can't exactly pack your vineyards up and take them with you if you jump ship, said Don Lorenzo. No, Locke sighed. It's the Ostershalin soils, in part, that make Ostershalin brandy. If we lose those vineyards, it will be just as it was before, an interruption of growth and distillation. 10, 20, maybe even 30 years, or more. And it gets worse. Our position is terrible. The Graf can't let Emberlane's ports and revenue go if the Marrows are coming to civil war. He and his allies will storm the place as fast as possible. They'll likely put the Black Table to the sword, impound their goods and properties, nationalize their funds. The House of Bel-Oster won't be spared. At the moment, the Black Table is acting quietly but firmly. Grau and I sailed 5 days ago, just 12 hours before we knew the port would be sealed off. No Emberlane-flagged ships are being allowed out. They're all being docked and secured for repairs or quarantine. Nobles still loyal to the Graf are under house arrest by now, their guards disarmed. Our funds in various lending houses of Emberlane have been temporarily frozen. All the Black Table merchant houses have consented to do this to one another. It makes it impossible for any house to flee en masse with its gold and its goods. Currently, Grau and I are operating on our local credit line, established at Maraggio's years ago. My house, well, we simply didn't keep our funds outside Emberlane, just a bit here and there for emergencies. Locke watched the Salvaras very closely for their reaction. His news from Emberlane was as fresh and specific as possible, but the Don might have sources of intelligence the gentleman bastards hadn't spotted in their weeks of surveillance and preparation. The parts about the Black Table and the impending civil war were solid, educated speculation. The part about a sudden port closure and house arrests was pure homespun bullshit. In Locke's estimation, the real mess in Emberlane wouldn't start for a few months. If the Don was wise to this, the game might be blown. Conte might be trying to pin Locke to the table with his daggers in just a few seconds. And then Jean would pull out the hatchets he had concealed down the back of his vest, and everyone in the little group beneath the silk awning would get very, very uncomfortable. But the Salvaras said nothing. They merely continued to stare at him with eyes that plainly invited him to go on. Emboldened, he continued. This situation is unbearable. We will neither be hostages to a cause that we barely profess, nor victims for the Graf's vengeance upon his inevitable return. We choose a somewhat risky alternative, one that would require substantial aid from a noble of Camor. You, Don Salvara, if it is within your means. The Don and his wife had clasped hands under the table. He waved his hand at Locke excitedly. We can surrender our funds. By taking no steps to secure them, we buy ourselves more time to act. And we are quite confident that replacing those funds will merely be a matter of time and effort. We can even abandon, Locke gritted his teeth, we can even abandon our vineyards. We will completely burn them ourselves, leaving nothing to anyone else. After all, we enhance the soil ourselves, alchemically, and the secret of that enhancement is kept only in the hearts of our planting masters.
The Ostershalin process, Sophia breathed, betrayed by her own rising excitement.
Of course, you've heard of it. Well, there are only 3 planting masters at any given time, and the process is complex enough to defy soil examination, even by someone with talents such as yours, my lady. Many of the compounds our alchemists use are inert, and intended only to confuse the matter. So that's that. The one thing we cannot abandon is our stock of aging blends, the last 6 years batched in their casks, and certain rare vintages and special experiments. We store the Osterschalin in 32-gallon casks. There are nearly 6,000 such casks in our possession. We have to get them out of Emberlane. We have to do it in the next few weeks, before the Black Table imposes harsher control measures, and before the Graf begins laying siege to his canton. And now our ships are under guard, and all of our funds are untouchable.
You want to get all of these casks out of Emberlane? All of them?
The Don actually gulped. As many as possible, said Locke.
And for this you would involve us how?
Doña Sofia was fidgeting. Emberlane flagged ships can no longer leave port, nor enter if they wish to escape again, but a small flotilla of Camorre-flagged ships with Camorre crews financed by a Camorre noble. Locke set his glass of brandy down and spread both his hands in the air.
You wish me to provide a naval expedition?
2 or 3 of your larger galleons should do it. We're looking at 1,000 tons of cargo, casks and brandy alike. Minimal crew, say 50 or 60 men a ship. We can take our pick of the docks and get sober, trustworthy captains. 6 or 7 days beating north, plus however long it takes to scratch the crews and ships together. I guess less than a week. Do you concur?
A week, yes, but you're asking me to finance all of this?
In exchange for a most handsome recompense, I assure you.
Provided everything goes well, yes, and we'll come to the matter of recompense in a moment, but just the rapid acquisition of 2 galleons, good captains, and very reliable crews.
Plus, said Locke, something to stick in the hold for the trip north. Cheap grain, dried cheese, low-grade fresh fruit, nothing special. But Emberlane will shortly be under siege. The Black Table will be happy to have a cache of extra supplies offloaded. Emberlane's position is too tenuous to fail to respect the sovereign neutrality of Camorre. That's what my masters are counting on to get the ships in and out. But added assurance cannot hurt.
Yes, said Don Lorenzo, tugging on his lower lip. 2 galleons, crews, officers, cheap cargo. A small crew of mercenaries, 10 or 12 a ship. There are always some hanging around the Viscount's gate this time of year. I'd want a hard corps of armed men on each ship to discourage complications.
Locke nodded.
So how exactly would we go about removing the casks from your aging houses and transporting them to the docks?
A very simple ruse, said Locke. We maintain several breweries and storehouses for small beer. It's a sideline, a sort of hobby for some of our blending masters. Our beer is stored in casks, and the location of these warehouses is public knowledge. Slowly, carefully, while Grau and I sailed south, my masters have been moving casks of Osterschalin brandy to the beer warehouses and relabeling them. They will continue to do so while we prepare here, and until our ships appear in the harbor of Emberlane.
So you won't be loading brandy in secret?
Doña Sofia clapped her hands together.
As far as anyone knows, you'll be loading beer in the open.
Exactly, my lady. Even the large export of beer won't be anywhere near as suspicious as a movement of the unaged brandy. It'll be looked on as a commercial coup. We'll be the first to dodge the interdict on Emberlane-flagged vessels. We'll bring in a pile of supplies for the coming siege and a fine apparent profit for ourselves. Then, once we've got all the brandy loaded, we'll put out to sea, bringing 60 or 70 Bell Oster family and employees to form the nucleus of our new business operations in Camor. Discovery after that will be immaterial.
All of this to be thrown together on short notice.
Don Lorenzo was deep in thought. 15,000 crowns, I'd say. Perhaps 20.
I concur, my lord. Count on an additional 5,000 or so for bribes and other arrangements.
Locke shrugged. Certain men are going to have to look the other way for us to do our job when we reach Emberlane, warehouse ruse or no.
25,000 crowns, then.
Damn. Lorenzo downed the last of the brandy in his glass, set it down, and folded his hands together on the table before him.
You're asking me for more than half of my fortune.
I like you, Lucas, but now it's time to discuss the other side of the proposal.
Of course. Lucas stopped to offer the Don another dash of the counterfeit unaged. The Don began to wave him off, but his taste buds prevailed over his better judgment, and he held out his glass. Doña Sofia did so as well, and Jean hurried over to pass her glass between her and Locke. When he'd served the Salvaras, Locke poured a companionably large amount into his own snifter.
First, you have to understand what the House of Bell Oster is and is not offering. You will never have the Osterschalen process. It will continue to be passed down verbally and strictly within the house. We can afford you no properties as collateral or in payment. We expect to forfeit them upon fleeing Emberlane. Resecuring the vineyards at a future date is our own problem. Any effort on your part to pry into the Osterschalen process to suborn any Bell Oster men or women will be regarded as an absolute breach of trust.
Locke sipped brandy.
I have no idea what specific penalties we could levy to express our displeasure, but it would be fully expressed. I am instructed to be entirely clear on this point.
And so you are.
Doña Sofia placed one hand on her husband's left shoulder.
But these limitations are not yet an offer.
Forgive me, gracious Doña Sofia, for speaking to you like this, but you must understand this is the most important thing the House of Bell Oster has ever contemplated. Grau and I hold the future of our combine in our rather vulnerable hands. At this moment, I can't speak to you just as your luncheon guest, Lucas Fairwhite. I am the House of Bell Oster. You have to understand that some things are not on the table, not even by the most remote implication.
The Salvaras nodded as one, Sofia just a bit more slowly than Lorenzo.
Now, consider the situation. War is coming to Emberlane. Our vineyards and our properties are as good as lost. And without those vineyards, there will be no Osterschalen actually produced for only the Marrows know how long. 10 years? A generation? Even when we have the vineyards back, the soil will need years to recover. This is the way it has been 3 times before. For many, many years to come, the only new Osterschalen available is going to come from whatever portion of those 6,000 casks we can move out of Emberlane, like thieves in the night. Imagine the demand. The price escalation.
The Don's lips moved unconsciously as he calculated. Doña Sofia stared off into the distance, her brow furrowed. Osterschalen brandy was the finest and most sought-after liquor known. Even the alchemical wines of Tal Varrar, in 100 bewitching varieties, were not as expensive. A single half-gallon bottle of the youngest available Osterschalen was 30 full crowns at retail. The price went up sharply with age. With a surprise shortage, a fixed supply, and no new crop of Osterschalen grapes in sight?
Fuck damn!
Said Conte, totally unable to help himself when the sums involved vanished over his mental horizon.
Beg pardon, Doña Sofia.
You should.
She drained her snifter in one quick, unladylike gulp.
Your calculations are off.
This merits a triple fuck-damn at least.
The House of Bel Oster, Locke continued, wishes to establish a partnership with you, based in Camor, to store and market Osterschalen brandy during our interregnum. In exchange for your assistance in transporting it from Emberlane in our moment of extreme need, we are prepared to offer you 50% of the proceeds from the sale of anything you transport for us. Again, consider the situation and the price of Osterschalen during a shortage. You could recoup your initial investment 10 times over in the first year. Give us 5 years, or 10.
Yes, Don Lorenzo fiddled with his optics. But Lucas, somehow, sitting here discussing the possible destruction of your house and the move to a city 500,000 miles to the south, you don't sound entirely displeased.
Locke used a particularly endearing wry smile he'd once practiced before a mirror glass for weeks.
When my masters grasped the essence of their current situation, some of them suggested we should have engineered an artificial shortage years ago. As it is, we are determined that we can turn a painful setback into a glorious return. Those 6,000 casks, sold at shortage prices over a number of years, we could return to Emberlane with a fortune that eclipses everything we'd be leaving behind. And as for your own situation,
we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of crowns. Doña Sofia returned from her thoughtful trance. We're talking about millions, even split between us.
It would be foolish to presume too much, but yes, there is the possibility that the sums involved could reach such figures. My masters are also prepared to grant one final compensation upon our successful return to Emberlane and the restoration of the Osterschalen vineyards. We offer your family a permanent stake in all Bel Oster operations thereafter. Certainly nothing close to a controlling interest, but something respectable, a 10-15% share. You would be the first and, we hope, the only foreigners ever offered such an interest.
There was a brief pause.
That's a very attractive offer, Don Salvara said at last. And to think all this was going to fall into Jacobo's lap simply by default. By the gods, Lucas, if we ever cross paths with those thieves again, I'm going to thank them for arranging our introduction.
Well, Locke chuckled, I, for my part, can let bygones be bygones. Grauman might feel somewhat differently. And the fact remains that while I sense we may be shaking hands very soon, we still have to assemble our ships, sail north to Emberlane, and snatch up our prize. The situation is like a damaged cargo rope, unraveling down to a single thread.
He saluted the Salvaras with his brandy snifter.
It will snap!
Out on the water, the devilfish was victorious, and the guards rewarded it for its service by filling it with poisoned crossbow bolts. Boat hooks and chains were used to haul the carcass out of the center of the shifting revel. There was just no putting a creature like that back into the box once it had served its purpose. The monster's red blood mixed with that of its victims and slowly settled in a broad, dark cloud. Even this had a deliberate part to play in what was to come next.
5. Scholars of the Therin Collegium, from their comfortable position well inland, could tell you that the wolf sharks of the Iron Sea are beautiful and fascinating creatures, their bodies more packed with muscle than any bull, their abrasive hide streaked with every color from old copper green to storm cloud black. Anyone actually working the waterfront in Camor and on the nearby coast could tell you that wolf sharks are big, aggressive bastards that like to jump. Carefully caged, starved, and maddened by blood, wolf sharks are the key to the customary highlight of the shifting revel. Other cities have gladiatorial games, other cities pit men against animals,
But only in Camor can you see a specially armed gladiator, a contrarachiala, battle a live, leaping shark. And in Camor, only women are allowed by tradition to be contrarachiala. This is the teeth show. 6. Locke couldn't tell if the four women were truly beautiful, but they were undeniably striking. They were all dark-skinned Camori with muscles like farm girls, imposing even at a distance, and they wore next to nothing, tight black cotton shifts across their chests, wrestlers' loincloths, and thin leather gloves. Their black hair was pulled back under the traditional red bandanas and threaded with brass and silver bangles that caught the sunlight in chains of white flashes. The purpose of these bangles was a matter of argument. Some claimed that they confused the poor eyesight of the sharks, while just as many claimed that their glare helped the monsters better sight their prey. Each contrarachiala carried two weapons, a short javelin in one hand and a special axe in the other. These axes had grips enclosed by full hand guards, making them difficult to lose. They were double-headed, with the expected curved blade on one side and a long, sturdy pick head on the other. A skilled fighter usually tried to slash a shark's fins and tail to nothing before making a kill. Few but the very best could kill with anything but the spike. Wolf shark skin could be like tree bark. Locke stared at the grim women and felt his usual melancholy admiration. They were, to his eyes, as mad as they were courageous.
"I know that's Cecilia de Ricura there on the far left."
Don Lorenzo was pointing the women out for Lucas Fairwright's benefit, taking a break from more than an hour of rapid negotiations.
"She's decent, and beside her is Agnesa, who carries her javelin but never ever uses it. The other two, well, they must be new, at least new to the revel."
"It's so unfortunate," said the Doña, "that the Barangius sisters aren't out there today, Master Fairwhite. They're the best."
"Probably the best there ever has been."
Don Salvara squinted to cut some of the glare rising off the water and tried to estimate the size of the sharks, barely visible as shadows within their cages.
"Or ever will be. But they haven't been at the revel for the past few months."
Locke nodded and chewed on the inside of one of his cheeks. As Locke Lamora, garista of the Gentleman Bastards and respectable sneak thief, he knew the Barangius twins personally. He also knew exactly where they'd been for those past few months. Out on the water, the first fighter was taking her position. Contrarachiala fought across a series of stepping stone platforms, each about 2 feet wide and raised half a foot off the water. These platforms were set out in a square grid, 4 or 5 feet apart, leaving plenty of room for the opposition to swim between them. The women would have to hop between these platforms at a rapid pace to strike out at the sharks, while dodging leaps in return. A slip into the water was usually the end of the contest. Beyond the line of shark cages, opened by chain pulleys connected to a barge well beyond the periphery of any possible shark activity, there was a little boat, crewed by extremely well-paid volunteer rowers, and carrying the three traditional observers of any teeth show. First, there was a priest of Yono, in his sea-green robes fringed with silver. Beside him, there was a black-robed, silver-masked priestess of Azaguiya, Lady of the Long Silence, Goddess of Death. Lastly, there was a physica, whose presence had always struck Locke as an extremely optimistic gesture.
"Camor!"
The young woman, apparently Cecilia de Ricura, raised her weapons into the air over her head. The heavy murmur of the crowd subsided, leaving only the noise of water lapping against boats and breakwaters. 15,000 watchers held their collective breath.
"I dedicate this death to Duke Nicovante, our lord and patron!"
Such was the traditional phrasing of the Contrarachiala's salute. This death could conveniently refer to either participant in the battle.
With a great flourish of trumpets and the cheer of the crowd, the boatmen outside the circle of cages loosed the afternoon's first shark. The 10-foot fish, already blood-mad, shot forth from imprisonment and began to circle the stepping platforms, its ominous grey fins slicing a ripple line in the water. Cecilia balanced on one foot and bent down to slap the water with the heel of the other, screaming oaths and challenges. The shark took the bait. In a few seconds, it was in amongst the platforms, stocky body whipping back and forth like a toothy pendulum. "This one doesn't like to waste time!" Don Salvara actually wrung his hands together. "I bet it's an early leaper!" Barely had these words escaped his mouth than the shark rocketed up out of the water in a fountain of silver spray, hurling itself at the crouching fighter. The shark's leap was not a high one. Cecilia avoided it by jumping right to the next platform over. In midair, she let her javelin go with a backhanded cast. The shaft sunk into the shark's flank and quivered there for a split second before the streamlined mass of hungry muscle splashed back down into the water. Crowd reaction was mixed. The cast had displayed remarkable agility but minimal power. Cecilia's shark was likely only further angered and her javelin wasted.
"Oh, poor decision," the Donya clicked her tongue. "This girl needs to learn some patience. We'll see if her new friend gives her the chance."
Thrashing, spraying pink-foamed water, the shark maneuvered for another attack, chasing Cecilia's shadow on the water. She hopped from platform to platform, axe reversed so the spike was facing outward.
"Master Fairwhite." Don Lorenzo removed his optics and played with them while he watched the fight. Apparently, they weren't necessary for use at long distances. "I can accept your terms, but you have to appreciate that my portion of the initial risk is quite heavy, especially relative to my total available funds. My request, therefore, is that the split of revenues from our Ostershalin sales be adjusted to 55-45 in my favor."
Locke pretended to ponder while Cecilia pumped her arms and leapt for dear life, the eager grey fin slashing through the water just behind her feet.
"I'm authorized to make such a concession on behalf of my masters. In return, I would fix your family's ownership interest in the resecured Ostershalin vineyards at 5%.
"Done,"
the Don smiled.
"I will fund 2 large galleons, crew and officers, necessary bribes and arrangements, and a cargo to take north with us. I'll oversee 1 galleon, you the other. Mercenary crews of my choosing to be placed aboard each vessel for added security. Conte will travel with you. Your Grauman can stay at my side. Any expenditures that bring our budget over 25,000 Komori crowns are to be made solely at my discretion."
The shark leapt and missed again. Cecilia performed a brief one-armed handstand on her platform, waving her axe. The audience roared while the shark rolled over gracelessly in the water and came back for another pass.
"Agreed," said Locke. "Signed identical copies of our contract to be kept by each of us. 1 additional copy in Therin to be kept with a mutually agreeable neutral solicitor, to be opened and examined by them within the month should one of us have an accident while fetching the casks. 1 additional copy in Vadran to be signed and placed into the care of an agent known to me for eventual delivery to my masters. I shall require a bonded scribe at the Tumble home this evening, and a promissory note for 5,000 crowns to be drawn at Maraggio's tomorrow so I can get to work immediately."
"And that is all that remains?"
"Quite everything," said Locke.
The Don was silent for several seconds.
"The hell with it. I agree. Let's clasp hands and take our chances."
Out on the water, Cecilia paused and hefted her axe, timing a blow as the shark approached her platform on her right, undulating, moving too slow for a high leap. Just as Cecilia shifted her weight to bring the spike down, the shark jackknifed in the water beside her, squeezing its body into a U-shape, and drove itself straight downward. This maneuver flicked its tail into the air, catching the contrarchiala just under her knees. Screaming more in shock than in pain, Cecilia de Ricura fell backward into the water. It was all over a few seconds after that. The shark came up biting and must have taken her by one or both legs. They turned over and over in the water a few times. Locke caught glimpses of the frantic woman's form alternating with the dark, rough hide of the shark. White, then grey. White, then grey. In moments, the pink foam was dark red once more, and the two struggling shadows were sinking into the depths beneath the platforms. Half the crowd roared lusty approval. The rest bowed their heads in a respectful silence that would last just until the next young woman entered the ring of red water.
Gods!
Doña Sofia stared at the spreading stain on the water. The surviving fighters stood with their heads lowered, and the priests were gesturing some sort of mutual blessing.
Unbelievable! Taken in so fast by such a simple trick! Well, my father used to say that one moment of misjudgment at the revel is worth 10 at any other time.
Locke bowed deeply to her, taking one hand and kissing it. I doubt him not at all, Doña Sofia. Not at all. Smiling amiably, he bowed to her once more, then turned to shake hands with her husband.